Accession number 17528, reel 3.
Mr. McSweeney, reel 3.
Well, the Subedar Major came out, and if I could have had a garland thrown over my neck, I'm sure I would have done. And everybody appeared wanting to see this son of their colonel, or the old, my father had been, of course, in command of that unit some time ago, but most of them knew him. And the reason why I want to finish this story is that they were part of a box. A box being one of those places, again, in the desert that was defended as a form of defense by guns and infantry and everything else, stuck out in various parts of the front. The front was not defended in any line at all. They were defended by boxes. That box was overrun subsequently by Rommel, but they held him up for so long, the Gurkhas, that the subsequent retreat that he made was almost the turning point of the First Battle of Alamein. That box has gone down in history, and it was my father's unit that was responsible. The fact that I actually met them there, I regard as something which is, I look back on with great pride. I think that's really all before I get on to the subject of Leros, which is my final, as it were, battle in this war.
Now, this brings us forward to, I think, the autumn of 1943.
That's right.
What unit were you in, and how did you come to be involved with the Dodecanese campaign?
Well, I was still with the 1st Light Anti-Aircraft Regiment and the 3rd Battery of this regiment, and I was battery commander. And what had happened was that the Italians had become our co-belligerents. They decided to pack it in. And there were 3 islands in the Dodecanese, Kos, Leros and Samos, that controlled that part of the Mediterranean between Turkey and Italy. Leros was the Rhodes was the key island of all, but wasn't part of that trio. And if we'd been able to take Rhodes, when the Italians decided to change sides, I think the story of the war would have been quite different, and we'd have finished it much earlier. As it was, we didn't. And Churchill felt that the underbelly of Europe was still the right place to attack from, and therefore Kos, Leros and Samos must, in fact, be held. So he sent troops to assist the Italian garrisons. And we got sent there. One unit of guns, light anti-aircraft guns, per island. Well, we hadn't got any guns, and how do we get guns onto Leros, Kos or Samos, other than really under the sea? At least nobody had actually thought of that beforehand. We just got dumped there anyway. Getting there is a story which is quite interesting, but I'm not going to include it at the moment. When we did arrive there, all that was happening was the Germans were perpetually bombing the island, and we had no other jobs to do than other than de defuse or blow up these various bombs. And I think that was probably more frightening than almost anything else I've ever done. But nobody else was seemed to having to do it. And this is how we spent our first few days and weeks. Subsequently, to our amazement, they had decided to put our Bofa guns on to the submarines. HMS 7 and HMS Rorqual were two of the submarines that were used to transport our guns from Haifa to Leros. And to our astonishment, having taken out the bits and pieces that really worked and kept them free from the salt, when we put them together, they worked perfectly. So, having had no guns at all, we then had six guns, six anti-aircraft guns, with which to work and attack or defend the island. Meanwhile, the Italians had a lot of guns, some big, very big guns indeed, coastal guns. And the anti-aircraft guns were all right, but they were manned by the southern Italians, and the southern Italians are not exactly the sort of chaps that really want to fight very hard. And the colonel in charge of all the guns on the island, including the Italians, promptly got an appendicitis and had to be whipped off at night, and ultimately back to Cairo. And they didn't replace him, and I was in charge of the whole lot. They didn't replace him, in fact, for five weeks. So I was in charge of not only my own lot, but also all these Italians. And I couldn't speak Italian, but I suppose it didn't matter terribly. The first day I went up there, around the gun sites, overcame the reconnaissance plane at 12 o'clock, German reconnaissance plane, you could time your watch by it. And the sentry, very sort of lackadaisically, managed to get the gun team out onto the predictor and the heavy anti-aircraft gun. But I noticed that, in fact, the predictor and the gun were both pointing in opposite directions. So I pulled out the plug from the predictor and just pointed to my finger, "Plano, plano," what I said. And two rather bemused men in the seats of the anti-aircraft gun, the Lares, ultimately laid up on the gun. Far, because the predictor had been in use, they got the height absolutely right. So the first shot was behind the plane. They then took two more turns on the handle, and they shot it out of the sky. It was the first shot gun, the plane they'd ever shot out at the sky, and the place went wild, absolutely wild. And being at southern Italians, they decided to have a party. And that party is something I'm never going to forget. Everybody seemed to appear from nowhere, out of the ground and everywhere. And I discovered where they lived in great style, with carpets, everything else down. And ultimately, girls came out of the fabric too. Typically Italian stuff. And we drank God knows how much booze, I don't know. I certainly couldn't go around the rest of the guns the rest of that day. But that was my introduction to the Italian gunnery. On the big guns, they were tremendous. The coastal gunners were all northern Italians, and one other anti-aircraft gun was also manned by northern Italians, and when the real fighting started, they were quite brilliant. Anyway, cut a long story short, I find myself in charge of all this lot, and various reasons, nobody seemed to be able to come and take over from me. I was just a major, I was 22, 3? 21. And I enjoyed what I was doing, strange enough. It was a funny period when we knew we were going to be invaded, and yet we wondered what else was going to happen. Well, having got our own guns, we kept fairly silent with them, actually, because we knew the invasion was coming and we didn't want the positions of them to be known too much, and we used to move them around. When the actual fighting started, just before the fighting started, and the Germans put in their big invasion stuff, Kos having been already invaded and fallen to the Germans in 24 hours, Samos hadn't got much garrison on it anyway, so it didn't matter very much. So we were the final target. And that battle really started with an invasion by sea and by air. It lasted 3 days. We clearly couldn't win it, in spite of the fact that three infantry battalions had already landed on the island, just about a week beforehand. The Navy, in transporting them, had lost three or four destroyers and a cruiser. It became one of the most expensive operations that ever had been taken, at Churchill's insistence, because of the underbelly of Europe business. Had the Americans actually given him all the what he asked for, to attack Rhodes, that would have been another matter. But however, returning to the story of Leros, the fighting lasted 3 days and three nights, and the parachute it's arrived, and it was an intensive battle, night and day. It was clearly not winnable, and eventually it was clear that we were going to lose, and by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, on the third day, we capitulated.
Was the role of your battery in an anti-aircraft or
in an anti-aircraft?
Another role?
No, in the anti-aircraft. But there wasn't any other role to play, really, because this island was only 8x3. With no tanks, no nothing else to take on. Entirely anti-aircraft, yeah.
And did you shoot any more planes
there? Oh, yes, quite a lot. I don't know, I can't remember what, in fact, we did put in and subsequently, because every single member of my unit, except for myself and one other subaltern, was taken prisoner. In fact, only 12 people escaped from the whole island out of 3,500 or something. And this happened to include myself. We were told that if the island was taken, that if we went and laid up in various particular coves around the coastal shore, the MTBs of the coastal units Jellicoe's special boat service would come in and pick us up at various appointed times, 3 o'clock in the morning or something, and we were given codes to flash a torch out. I was completely unable to make contact with any of my guns. They were all spread out all over the island, and it was a question of every man for his own could make his own way to wherever he thought he was, could lay up on in whatever hiding place he could find, ultimately to hope to be taken off by the SBS. I was feeling pretty grim, and to say the least of it. And I really could hardly move, but luckily I found my way down to the main harbour, where the Nafi was being very quickly, the Nafi stores were being very quickly distributed, and I got hold of a bottle of whiskey, which made a lot of difference. And we also stacked up one or two biscuits and things. And I was joined by two chaps I didn't know, and also one of my own officers. And we made our way up to the spot right over one of these high peaks, down onto the beach below, where to lay up in the hope of being picked up. Well, we lay there for 3 days and three nights, and the Germans were really within almost calling distance. We could hear what they were going on the whole time. And we thought, well, gosh, after the third night, we'd have to give ourselves up. But we'd heard a tremendous bang sometime that day, and so two of the subalterns went off to look and see what had happened. And they came back, having walked through a minefield, and said that there was a boat which had a hole in it, a caique, about, 12 foot by 8 foot. And it had still some oars and some extraordinary looking rollocks. But if we wanted to make our way on our own, we would have to mend this boat. And they said, well, we've got these jerry cans, which are the British jerry can was, unlike the German jerry can, was made of very thin tin, but you very malleable, so you could cut it in half and take the bits of this this metal and weld them into, or meld them into shape, as we did to try and mend these holes in the boat. That evening, when again there were no further, there was no arrival of Jericho's men, we all traipsed through this minefield rather gingerly and put the boat in the water, hoping to row to Turkey, which is 14 miles away. The wind was getting up, and we started to row, and only two of us had ever rowed before. A Greek oar is only about 3 inches wide, and there were no rollocks, and the whole thing was the most difficult thing you could possibly operate. We made some rollocks out of bits of rope. 3 o'clock in the morning, and the Meltemi wind from the north east was blowing a gale, and we were being blown onto the rocks of an island called Castel Lerozzo, which of course I knew that well, because in charge of the guns, I'd been looking at this and island, and I knew that the Germans had been actually accumulating troops there for the invasion. Well, it was a question of being blown onto the rocks and drowned, or I didn't know what else. And I make no bones about it, I produced a very strong prayer, and it was immediately answered by a strange thing. But because I was in charge of all the guns, I looked at Castelrozzo, and I knew all the little coves that along that coast. And I said, if we row for another 100 yards, there's an inlet in there, and I know we'll be okay. We rowed that 100 yards, and we found this inlet, absolutely, totally sheltered from the storm. We were all soaked, and I was determined that, in fact, I was going to light a fire irrespective of anything. And the other seven members of the boat tried to dissuade me, but I said, no, I don't want to get pneumonia, and what's the point of it all? So we did. There was a small chapel there, and next morning we looked around and thought, well, the wind was still blowing very, very powerfully, but we were very hungry. And we looked up, and there was a herd of goats up on the hill. And I said, right, that's what we're going to feed from. And they said, oh, well, I said, well, it's very easy to this. Let's face it, we're going to go miles around them, and then we're all going to gradually move in, and subsequently, when we get as close as we can before they start to move, one of us is, well, we just got to overpower them. We might get one, certainly. So this is what we did. And I was foolish enough to arrive first and the whole lot on top of me. But we got our goat, and luckily we had a butcher amongst our eight, and he slit the goat's throat, and we skinned it and cooked it in this wonderful, of course, we had salt water, but it was the best meal I think I can ever remember tasting for years and years and years. I shall remember it. So we survived. Next night was pretty stormy, and we didn't think we could make it, and so we had another day there, and we were approached by a shepherd, and we thought, well, no, we don't want to go with him, please, thanks very much. And we hoped he wasn't in cahoots with the Germans. And the following night we set sail again, having mended the boat a bit more, and rowed to Turkey, which was another 8-10 miles. And then ultimately, when there were quite a number of sort of e-boats looking for us still, and Ju-88s flying around, but they didn't seem to worry us unduly. And we escaped and arrived on the Turkish shore, 12 miles north of Badrun, B-A-D-R-U-N, which is now, of course, a very large tourist resort, which was one of the main harbours. On the way back to Badrun, we stopped at a village, and the villagers, the Turkish villagers, of course, actually delighted to see us, but the Germans, of course, were put into the local jail, and they wanted us to go and sort of gloat, and I said, no, we can't do that. And we sort of waved at them. These were German pilots who'd come down in the drink. And ultimately went our way back to Badrun in a caique, and we got pushed on board and had to give all our stories, and then were sent across the Mediterranean in an RAF high-speed launch at the most incredible speed, 400 miles in the hour, in just over the night. We arrived at about 8 o'clock.
Where to?
In Alexandria.
What condition were you in by the time you got to Alexandria?
Pretty ropey. I had pneumonia. and I got pushed straight into hospital.
And how many came back with you?
Just that eight. Four swam to northern Turkey. Two others escaped by means of some other means which I have never heard of, but I think only 14 of us actually got away from that island. We were very, very fortunate. Subsequently, I was sent for by having been sent to hospital. I was surprised by our delightful regimental padre, who came and gave me the news that for some inexplicable reason I'd been awarded the DSO. And my father had sent me a telegram saying, "Well done, third generation," which didn't mean anything to me because I knew he'd got one, but I'd forgotten that my grandfather had one. Or never been told, I think. So really, that... Oh yes, well, one other thing. I was summoned to see the Field Marshal Wilson, Jumbo Wilson, when I got out of hospital. He wanted to know more about Leros and what had happened, because we were the only people that got back, and I was just about the senior officer. I told him, and I had the nerve to say, "Well, actually, as I was a senior officer on the island for some time, do you think I could have some pay?" And he looked at me, and he rang a bell, and in came the paymaster. He said, "Look, I think this chap's been doing a brigadier's job or something, and I think really we ought to give him some money." The paymaster didn't look very happy about it. And he said, "What about £100? And the paymaster looked even less happy. But I got it for doing this job. £100, and there's a lot of money. After that, it was a question of being told I was going to be sent back home to Staff College, and I was able then to marry this girl, Julia, who I'd met earlier.